My undergrad was a 5-year program, and it was in the junior year that I met this sophomore girl. Jim Page came up to my room, and Jim said, "Have you met this Julie Lawrence?" I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Wow." These true words. He said, "You know," he said, "she's impressive." He said, "This is Jim Page talking." He said, "You know, I would date her if I wasn't already dating Nancy." And then he says, "You ought to meet her." So it was probably that day, the next day, sometime, Jim went over in the cafeteria where she was sitting, and I was with him, and he said, "Let me introduce you." And I sat down with a group of 6 or 7 people, and so Julie was there at that table, and I remember we sat there probably 45 minutes to an hour, the whole group talking, and I went back to my dorm, and I turned to Jim, and I said, "Well, she's really nice. I mean, she really is nice, but she's not my type. I don't know what that is, but anyhow, I went to class. This was just a little before school was actually supposed to start. There were some leadership things we were all on campus a little early for. And I went to class, and lo and behold, I had her in 2 classes. And so first time, I'd been in one. There's a series of classes that I had that took 6 semesters to actually go through this one sequence. And I had been in already 2 or 3 of those. And I was in the same room, same professor, you know, that sort of thing. And I always sat in the same chair about right there, somewhere about 3 rows back, 2 rows back. And well, I saw Julie came in, and she sat all the way at the back by herself. Well, being a chivalrous kind of guy, I got up from where I normally sat, and I knew she didn't know anybody. She'd transferred in as a sophomore. She'd come from Oklahoma State University. So I went back and sat down beside her, and so we had a small talk visit before class starts. And then she has a girl from her floor in her dorm who happened to walk in. It was the first girl that Julie knew in there, and the girl kind of waved at her, and the girl sat down up here, and she motioned to Julie, "Come sit." And Julie got up and left me sitting back there by myself. And well, they're shot down already on somebody I'm not interested in, you know, sort of thing. But I had her in another class as well, and which is a little bit odd to have that much overlap. We went through that fall of that year. And I don't mind telling you, I became more and more captivated by this gal. This gal was somebody that intrigued me. I finally called her about the 1st of January, somewhere early then, and I asked her for a date. And would you like to go out? She turned me down. Now, she was very kind about it. She said she really had to wash her hair. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. She actually said, "I would like to go with you." And she said, "But I turned down another boy for the same weekend that I didn't want to go with, and it wouldn't be right for me to say yes to you when I told him no, I wasn't going to go out that weekend." Later on, her roommate told me, she said, "Did you know you were the 5th guy to call her that night?" I was number 5 to get shot down. But she was kind enough. She said, "Would you please call back? Would you please call back? So I took that as an opening. I waited 10 minutes. No, I must have waited another week or 10 days, and I called her up. And this is the middle of January, and I don't know why I did it. It was pretty close to Valentine's Day that I actually could go out with her. In fact, it turned out there was a big Valentine's party that they had, and so I took her as my Valentine's date. I went back to my room when the date was over. I turned to my roommate, and I said, "She's the one." I said, I'm all the way in. I said, "I'm in." She went back to her roommate, and she didn't use the exact language, but she went back to her roommate, and she said, "He's the one. I'm all the way in." And we started dating, and we were engaged early summer, and we got married the next January. If my children try to date their first date in February and get married, you know, engaged in June, I'm going, you know, I'd shoot them. But anyhow, but that's what we did. I was headed out of country, and I got a phone call from my son. My son was in law school up at MU, and he said, "Dad," he said, I guess I don't want you to read too much in this, but he said, "There's this girl." A lot of stories start off that way. And he said, "Dad, I'm pretty captivated. I'm getting kind of serious about her. I guess I want just a sounding board. Dad, here's what I see." And we talked. That was probably in the fall. In January, I was headed to Afghanistan. And I got an email on one of them email machines. But the email was, "Dad, I think while you're gone, I'm probably going to propose to Molly. I think she'll say yes." That means they've already talked about it. And he said, "Dad, I want a sounding board. Here's what I see in Molly." My daughter, Katie, she's a physician assistant, a PA. She gave me a call. She said, "Dad, can I meet you for lunch tomorrow?" And said, "Be happy to." I said, "You now make a better salary than I make. You pay." And she, and we went out to lunch. She was dating a guy from a congregation that I knew and is a guy that I really admired in our church. But she said, "Dad, I guess I want a sounding board. If Josh asks me to marry him, I think I'll say yes. Am I making the right decision, Dad?" "I think I am, but how do you know?" And we talked for almost 2 hours in a restaurant. And about 3 weeks later, Josh asked her. How do you know on these things? How do you know who to marry? Truth is, you're in a culture that you can take your clues from them because they don't know. Can I tell you about just my lifetime? Just in my lifetime. And I may look old to you, but it's happened in the blink of an eye. In 1959, I would have been 5 years old, and there were 395,000 divorces in this country. 395. By 1965, we had changed that. We had increased it by almost 100,000. It was about 480,000 divorces. By 1975, moving from 65 to 75, actually 1977, we had 1.1 million divorces. We'd more than doubled it. By 1985, we doubled that. We went from 1.1 million divorces to 2.2 million divorces. So from the time that I was five, with 395,000 divorces a year in this country, for the mid-80s, 2.2 million. Now that means you grew up in an entirely different world than I grew up in. And the expectations and the way you live and how you make family work. By the way, since the mid-80s, things haven't changed much. It stayed pretty constant. A little minor dip or a little minor up. So about 2.2 million divorces a year. But here's the kicker. There's 30% less marriages. So from the mid-80s to right now, 30% less marriages, but we still have 2.2 million. How do you know? How do you know who to marry? What's God's will for this? Is it you marry the person you just fall in love with? The answer to that is no. Any fool can fall in love, and falling in love is easy. Falling in love has almost no predictor whatsoever of what you're going to have, other than it's got some scary things to it. Tonight, what I want to do in the time that we have is I just want to talk through what I understand as clear as I can, the same kind of conversation I would have with my daughter over a meal, the same conversation I'd have with my son. I want to leave tomorrow having done the best I can to hand you a framework where this is how you decide. obviously you can't use this just as your decision of who you to marry. You've got to take this back three steps. You've got to make this about your decision about who you begin to really invest in and get serious about. Because if you go past all those stop signs and you start getting really serious about somebody else, it's not hard to go past that stop sign on marriage. So I'm actually saying, do you know who's God's what God's will is for who you're to actually begin to relationally connect with? Let's start with the first one. It is very clear in Scripture that the command of God, that the instruction of God, and by the way, you do realize, don't you, all commands and instructions of God are ultimately expressions of God's love. All commands are God's way of trying to love and protect us. All commands are the same way I might pick up one of my grandkids and say, no, sweetheart, don't play with next to the stove. It's hot. Please, sweetheart, don't play next to the street like that because trucks run by here really fast. All of Grandpa's commands for my grandkids come out of my great love. God's commands for who to marry, number one, you're told to marry someone who's wise. Someone who's wise. I know that word doesn't connect with us very well in this culture. You're not sure what that means. But the idea in the book of Proverbs is very clear. You're told to run from a foolish man, run from a foolish woman. I mean, run. Close your eyes, so to speak, and run really, really hard. Don't look back. Don't run from a foolish man, run from a foolish woman. You're told to always marry somebody who's wise. The word wise ultimately means whole, someone who's well. There was a theologian, great theologian, many of you may know by the name of Colin Cowherd. Yeah, that's what I thought you'd do. A few of you who are not real bright like me listen to sports talk radio. ESPN is what Colin Cowherd is on. Colin Cowherd is a pagan. He is a brilliant man. He has a high IQ, but he is a pagan through and through. But the other morning, he talked about, he said, you know, I've failed in marriages. He said, you know, I've failed in a lot of things. He was just being really honest about his own life. Colin Cowherd said, you know, intelligence, IQ is what we were all raised. That if somebody had a high IQ, he said, IQ is not the secret to life. EQ is the secret to life. Someone who has an emotional quotient. He said, somebody who has wholeness. He said, you know, he said, the reason that my marriages have failed is my wives have married a guy who didn't have wholeness. And he said, right now, I don't much care. I'm having a good time in life. I don't care. And he said, and I've married women who didn't have wholeness, and I didn't care because I saw what they looked like. And Colin Cowherd is talking, if you don't mind me taking the other side of the world, a Colin Cowherd who is stating the culture, even there he's right, you marry someone who has wholeness if you want real relationships. And he began to talk about what it's like to be a single dad seeing these kids. Wholeness. This is really, really important you understand this portion, and I'll try to do it where it makes sense. You were born with the instinctive desire to love and be loved. That's instinctive. Everybody's born with that. I'm amazed at this instinctive desire. You look how a baby calf, and that's the background, I came from a ranch and all those things. A baby calf hits the ground, and this long-legged, awkward thing begins to stand to its feet, and immediately that calf knows to try to go look for an udder and to suck on a mother. And you're going, how does this calf know to start taking its head and trying to bang somewhere to try to find somewhere on the side of the body of this cow to try to find an udder? And you watch that and you go, I don't understand how God put that instinct automatically in this thing that can barely stand. Instinctively, how do birds know to migrate north and south? Instinctively, how does the whale know how to migrate across the oceans? There are instinctive things that are within us. It is instinctive for a human being when we're born, this desire to love and be loved. I don't care, be you saint or be you scoundrel. Everybody has the same thing. Go to the deepest, darkest prison. That guy wants to love his family. He wants to love his wife. He wants to love his kids. He wants to be loved by his family. There is a universal concept of the desire to love. But here's the problem. While the desire to love is instinctive, the ability to love is not. the ability to love depends upon character and wholeness. And so while you have the desire to love, you have to reach into your backbone. That's a word I brought up before, I think. You have to reach into your backbone, you have to reach into your character, and you have to bring out the things that are required to live love out, which is forgiveness and mercy and patience and courage and honor and nobility and self-discipline. Just the stuff of wisdom the book of Proverbs talks about. And so the scripture says, marry somebody who's wise. Why? Because any fool will want to love you. But they will frustrate themselves to death because when they reach in their character to bring out what's required to really live out love, it's not there. And so what happens is couples stand in this culture over and over and hold each other's hands and they say, I do take you. My wife, I do promise to have you and hold you from this day forward, for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and health, in love and to cherish, till death shall separate us. And they intend it. But when they go home, a shell of a man or a shell of a woman, and they reach in, and it's not there, and they make promises they can't keep, promises they'd like to keep. I've said it before, nobody wakes up at 5 in the morning and says, I'm going to screw up my wife's life today. I'm going to screw up my kid's life today. What happens is they get up and they reach into their life to pull out wholeness and wellness and wisdom, and it's not there. And they weep over it too. They're weeping, they don't let you see, but they get so frustrated at themselves and they can't decide whether it's you the problem or them the problem or the world the problem or who gives a blank. I can't tell, it's just not working. And they get so frustrated. If I get really, really personal on this, everybody comes from a family. You know the story I'm telling you. Your daddy wanted to love you. You've not felt loved by your dad your entire life. I can tell you right now, I haven't met your dad, but your dad wanted to love you. Your dad beat his head against a wall in private. Your dad was so frustrated he couldn't figure out why does life work for other people and why can they love their families and why did their families feel loved and why? And he's just frustrated. He's almost in some ways like Kinley shoving cookie sheets and it just doesn't work. And what your dad never really figured out was he didn't have enough wholeness and wellness to really love you. Your mama wanted to love you. Many of you who grew up with moms and you just struggled your entire life and you've never felt your mom's love, please know it's instinctive. She wanted to love you. But there was a hole in her chest. There was something in her world that she never became fully well. And it takes a wise, whole person to live out love. That concept is indispensable. And so I say to you with great passion on this subject, that if you don't choose to be a whole person yourself, if you never come to wholeness, you're going to always be an empty well trying to dip into it and bring out that which you want to give to your family, but your bucket's going to come up empty. And you will be a frustration to the very people who you most want to love. You've got to find your own wholeness first. The reason some of you need to quit dating who you're dating is not because they're so much of a problem. But the problem is you need to say, I have unfinished business. Until I become a man or woman of God who has substance and wisdom and wholeness in my life. Nobody ever becomes the epitome of it. I understand that. And it always takes a handful of godly friends who help us and escort us in that journey. And I mean, I understand all that. But the point being is you're going to be a leaner and a taker and a user. You're going to be somebody who makes promises you can't keep until you become whole. And so you look at your parents and you say, wow, I wish they had a great marriage. I talk to mom, I talk to dad. I mean, I know they love each other at some level, but they can't seem to make it work. And I keep trying to put them back together and it just doesn't work because there's a level of deepness you don't see. And that is there's a hole in this wholeness. You can't be that person. Can I tell you what captured my heart about Julie? And I was dumb and silly like every other young boy, but I can tell you this. what captured me about my wife was she had a kindness and a compassion. Julie was a bit of a star. She didn't act like a star. Julie sang at the World's Fair as a soloist. Julie sang all over this country as a solo. I mean, she would have been an American Idol finalist. She sang at the Midwest Governors Conferences and those sort of things. Julie was very, very good. She'd sing on stage, and she had a little bit of that star quality. But I was in class, and I noticed that she gave no preferential treatment to the in crowd. She was very kind with them, but she was just constantly just taking care of people. She was kind to guys like me. And I noticed that Julie had just such integrity, and I noticed she had just this emotional wellness. And I became more and more impressed by her wholeness. I married a wise woman. She was a wise 19, 20-year-old girl. But that's the kind of person I want to share the rest of my life with, and that's who I want raising my kids and my grandkids. And I'm married over my head. You have to do that. Well, how do you know what wholeness is? How do you tell? If you do not know it yourself, you won't recognize it in other people. I also would tell you, if you don't know Scripture, if you don't know Proverbs, if you don't know what Christ's character is, if you don't understand just the biblical model, you'll have trouble telling. Let me use one quick thing, that kind of an illustration. Let me tell you where you're going to make sure that you can clearly tell wholeness is not there. Let me use an illustration. Book of Proverbs has a passage that just captivates me. Book of Proverbs says, and this is just one illustration of wholeness or lack of wholeness. Book of Proverbs says that a man without self-discipline is like a city without walls. Well, what's that mean? Well, a man who doesn't have wholeness in his life and wisdom in his life, and he's not able to discipline his life in healthy, godly ways, that man is like a city without walls. I want you to picture two cities side by side. One city with walls and one city without walls. In both cities, they want the same things. In both cities, they have marriages, and in both cities, they have babies, and in both cities, they kiss their babies on foreheads and put them to sleep at night. In both cities, they have birthday parties, and in both cities, they live life. They have the same hopes and dreams and aspirations. In both cities, they have grandparents and just life occurring. In both cities, they take the winter wheat and so to speak, and put it aside so they can plant it again in the spring and all those sort of things. In both cities, they're just alike. Here's the problem. Come spring, the city without walls, those things are not there. Because the city without walls, raiders come and carry the kids off. In the city without walls, vandals come in and steal and take the grain. In the city without walls, all of the hopes and dreams and aspirations just never come to fruition because there's no protection. Let me be just as painfully and straight honest. Take any one of you girls, and you begin to invest in a guy, and he's a likable guy, he's funny, he seems like a sweet guy, so many good things about him. But if I ask you, is he whole, is he wise, is he a city with walls? You say, well, I don't know, he's kind of immature in lots of ways, and yet he's a great guy, so I really like him, and he loves me, and we get along well. And The most dangerous man on the face of the earth is not the scoundrel. The most dangerous person on the face of the earth is not the scoundrel. If you come in contact with a scoundrel, you smell that pretty quickly. You see that pretty quickly. You back away. You don't let yourself get too hurt by a scoundrel. If a snake is a snake is a snake, everybody kind of figures out pretty quick. The most dangerous man on the face of the earth is the man who wants the right things, the man who talks about the right things, the man who has a good heart and wants the right things to take place, but he's never built self-discipline and godliness all the way through his life. He's like a city without walls. And the woman who marries him will find herself always frustrated because she has these dreams and hopes, but she has a man who can't protect them because he's never come to wholeness. The most dangerous woman on the face of the earth is a sweet, likable gal. And she's fun to be around. But she's never come to wholeness. And she doesn't have the walls in her life. And so when you have babies with this girl. You're going to get your heart broke. Because she wants the right things. She talks about the right things. And she has the right inclinations. And she has a good heart. But she's never come to personal maturity. She's never come to self-discipline where it's a part of her life. And when she reaches into her backbone and her character to live out how to love her husband and love her kids, she comes out more empty-handed than she should. And she is always, always going to keep breaking your heart. Fools are not bad people. They're not scoundrels. They're likable. Fools are funny. I mean, they're enjoyable. Like them. I mean, they have sweet moments. But they're not wise. My grandson, Ian, is about to turn 5. He's wonderful. He is a sweet little boy. I love Ian. He has such an exuberance to life. He's joyful. He's very polite. He wants to be very careful. But he's a foolish boy. He's a fool. He's a sweet, wonderful little boy, but he has never grown up to where he has his own sense of personal contentment and his own personal happiness and his own personal morality. And until that happens, as sweet as he is, he just doesn't have maturity. So too is the story of 23-year-old boys and 33-year-old boys and 43-year-old boys. In the Jewish culture, you were a man and you had maturity when you became 13. In our culture, when you start turn 16 and you can drive, your friends start treating you like you're a man. Hey, you're a man. Age 18, the government says you're a man. You graduate from college age 21, 22, and they give you a diploma, and you're a college graduate, you're a man. All of those may be liars. Scripture says you're not a man until courage and honor and nobility and self-discipline and wholeness comes. Don't let age confuse you. Look for wisdom. Let me use just, I'll run out of time. I better quit. Let me brush across a couple things. Let me tell you other indicators. For example, I use that Proverbs passage, a man without walls. Let me use another one. If you are dating someone for whom even the sexual boundaries prior to marriage get broken, you know you're dating a fool and you know you are one. It's funny about the sexual sin. The sexual sin can be so explained away by fools, and the sexual sin is seen so different by a wise individual. You got a guy who has a little trouble keeping his hands from where they ought to be. You have a guy who sort of leaves the choice up to you, but you know if you gave in a little bit, he would be more than happy to go further if you kind of gave in a little, bucking the gals. Obviously, you guys, you recognize sexual messages in the girl you're dating. You need to know that courage and honor and nobility and self-discipline and wholeness basically say, sweetheart, I love you enough. Yes, I would love to be sexual with you now. That's what my flesh calls out for. But I understand the heart and the will of God, and I wouldn't damage you or hurt you. I wouldn't dishonor you. I will wait till I marry you. You'll be treated with honor and dignity by me. If a guy can't treat you with honor and dignity prior to your marriage, I guarantee you the pattern. You'll have to fight afterwards. I've done this years ago. I did this years ago, and then I did it again recently, about 3 years ago. I work with a little over 100 problem marriage couples a year right now. And one of the questions that I ask, I'll take a year where I ask this to every couple, were you sexually active prior to marriage? It always turns out the same. Out of just make it round numbers. If it's 100 people, if it's 100 couples that I work with that year, about 2 new families every week that I get started in on problem marriage counseling. And by the way, anymore, we have other counselors who take them. I'm the bridge. I take them for about the first 4 to 5 sessions, the first 3 to 5 sessions, depending, and then I pass them on to the next process that we use. But I ask these questions: were you sexually active prior to marriage? Were you sexually active with each other prior to marriage? out of any time that I have 100 couples, you can almost always guess about 95 of those will say yes. About a 95% accuracy that they were sexually active prior to marriage. You couldn't be more of a terrorist to your own marriage. I mean, it'd be like planting a pipe bomb in your dating years so it explodes and goes off in your marriage years. You see, being sexually active is both an indicator that you're not whole and you're not wise and you're not well and you don't look after the other one well. And then the other factor is it has repercussions you cannot know that are saved up, that explode, and at 5 years into your marriage, 3 years into your marriage, 8 years into your marriage. It's like hiding a pipe bomb in your own life. Wholeness. Wholeness. Marry somebody who's wise. I want to make this statement as well. It is very clear that while we're made for community and everybody has to live in community, not everybody has to live in marriage. You have to come to the place, men and women, that I would be okay. My first choice might be to have a family and to have, but if that never happened, I'd be okay. You've got to come to that place. You've got to come to that place. And if you never meet someone who's whole and wise that you want to give the rest of your life to, it's perfectly fine to be single. I guarantee you far less bruises and scarring on that than to lower your standards and marry somebody who's not wise and not whole and not well. In fact, I admire those of you that are single by choice because you wouldn't compromise. I know it's a bit of a throwaway line, but it's still true. Anybody can be married if you set your standards low enough. That's truth. You set your standards low enough, you could be married in 20 minutes. We'll find somebody and we can pull it off. But if you actually have standards where you say, look, I'm not compromising on this, it is an incredibly different. I keep looking at my watch. I end up ignoring it, and I know I go long all the time anyhow. This is just a hobby of mine, really. Let me comment on one other thing about wholeness will do. This is absolutely essential to understand. Without wholeness, a person doesn't even understand themselves, let alone understand the other gender. One of the biggest problems we find in marriage among foolish people is they do not know how to treat the other gender because we're not the same. God wired us different. I don't mean to be crass with this, but if you want to marry somebody you understand, you better marry within your own gender. Yuck. I don't like the sound of that. The reality is, whenever you begin to get into a marriage, you're going to marry someone who is difficult for you to understand because you're crossing gender lines and we are very different. If somebody doesn't have wholeness and wellness, they don't understand their own life, let alone learn how to understand and treat the other. Do you know, if you are a man, do you know what the number one thing your wife will need all of her life? It will never vary. Do you know what it is? Do you know how to invest in her? I talked about how love number three is basically this idea of you get up in the morning and you say, Heavenly Father, I want to be your servant in her life today. I want to worship you that way. Do you know how to invest into a woman's life? And do you have the character to be able to do it? A woman, the same prayer. If a woman's going to love a man, how does she love him? What's he need? We're very different. You know that. I tell this story, and I will keep it brief for those of you who have heard me do this many times. And by the way, I do speak on other subjects every now and then. You guys are, you ask me consistently on this, and I am honored. I sometimes feel bad for you. You've heard it 13 times. But I think God, how he opened my eyes in some ways to illustrate the difference between men and women had to do with the birth of my own first two children. Troy and Katie are 18 months apart in age. And so I have this little boy. And so I have a little boy who's 3 years old, to use my story, my illustration where you can see it. I could come home at the end of the day of work, and I have a three-year-old little boy who's been waiting on the front porch, playing with trucks and tractors, waiting for his father to come. And when I would come in the door, boy, my three-year-old boy gets so excited, and he would immediately, a little boy would grab my hand, begin to pull me into the room and say, Daddy, come look, Daddy, come see. Daddy, come look. Daddy, come see. And a three-year-old little boy who had been waiting all day long for me to come. Now, he has a toddler sister around there that I want to say hi to, and his mother. And I mean, he wasn't rude or mean. In fact, he was a very quiet and gentle child, and yet it was still very adamant. Daddy, please come look. Daddy, please come see. And I learned very early you could crush a little boy's heart by not having time to go look or go see. So I would go look, and he would take me to the room, and he would show me something, something he'd made, built, learned, destroyed, or tore up. And I learned very early you could crush a little boy's heart by looking down at whatever it was he had done and saying, Troy, that's not so good. Can't you color in the lines better? Or say, Troy, that's backwards. No, the big ones go on the bottom and the little ones go on top, or whatever it was. No, I could crush a little boy's heart. A little boy, it's born in a little boy. The thing he wanted was this. Was he wanted to hear a voice that said, wow, sweetheart, I'm impressed. Can we tear that out and mail that to Grandma? Is that okay? Do you mind if we tear that out and we'll put that in the refrigerator? Or, Troy, that's really wonderful. Troy, I am so proud of you. So I think I have three-year-old little boys figured out. If you really want to love a little boy, just brag on him. So I come along 18 months later, and Katie is now three. I assume the secret to life is just brag on your kids and it'll all turn out, because boys and girls, I assumed, are kind of the same. They're not. I would come in that same door, and Katie, at age three, Katie would do the same thing, but she would run up and give me a hug around my legs, and then Katie did something that you girls, bless your hearts, it's hardwired in you. Katie would run off about as far as you are from me. After she'd given me my hug, she'd put her hands on her hips. She would turn her head with this little tease. And she said, and this is a true statement that she said, she said, today I'm not Daddy's girl, I'm Johnny's girl. What? Johnny turned out, it turned out to be a brother-in-law. At that time he was dating my wife's sister. Today, I'm not Daddy's girl, I'm Johnny's girl. Well, you know, I could ruin her day by going, no, you know, by saying, fine, be Johnny's girl, see if I care, you know. No. My line was that my line was, oh, no, you're not Johnny's girl, you're Daddy's girl. No, I'm not, I'm Johnny's girl. No, you're not Johnny's girl, I'm Daddy's girl. And we would do that little exchange, and then she would take off and run behind a recliner. There was a big, huge recliner we had over on the side of the wall, and she would get behind it, giggling. And I'd go stomping across the floor, you know. And I'm taking my hand and reaching back behind that recliner to find a little girl. And I would find a body part. And I would pull a little three-year-old little girl out who's just giggling up a storm behind the chair. And a three-year-old little girl, when I pulled her out, would give me the big hug, and she would say, okay, today I'll be Daddy's girl. Daddy, would you read to me? And we would sit in a chair, and she'd sit on my lap, and we'd read. Now, I'm not telling you a one-day deal. I'm telling you repeated patterns day after day after day. What's going on in the little girl's heart? What's the craving and desire of a little girl's heart? And what's the craving of a little boy's heart? The answer is they're different. From the time three-year-old little boys hit this world, the one thing they want to know in life is, anybody proud of me? Have I done anything that you respect or admire? What's the craving of a little girl's heart? Do I matter to you? Do you have time for me? Am I important to you? My kids grew up. Troy would be 13, shooting baskets out on the concrete pad by himself. He would come and sort of knock on the door to the living room, and he would say, hey, Dad, come out here. I want you to see something. Hey, Dad, I want to show you something. And I would go out, and there was always this 13-year-old boy, tall and gangly and all those things. And he would say, hey, Dad, I want you to see this. And he would show me something. He's very much got my genetics, so it wasn't a dunk, I promise you. But he's showing me how he's dribbling or how he's shooting or something. And I got a I got a 13-year-old boy who's like every other kid. He's tried to hide it a little bit, but what's he throwing out as a lure? What he's throwing out and hoping I'll bite on would be the kinds of things where I go, son, that's pretty impressive. Nice job. He always wanted to play me one-on-one, and play me a lot, very competitive. You know boys are competitive. I'd beat him when he was age 13 very easily because I'd cheat, but... But his favorite thing was to watch me huff and puff and lean against the side of the house, and I would say to him, wow, Troy, nice job. You could have quit when I had you down quite a ways. Nice job. My son is 30, almost to turn 31. It hasn't changed. I know what my son needs from Molly. My son still wants to know, does anybody notice? Is anybody proud of me? He doesn't have a horrible ego of some kind. He's just a man. And unless Molly is secure enough in her own wisdom and in her own wholeness, she can't reach into her own character and bring out the things required to love a 30 or 31-year-old man who just wants somebody to be proud of him. Katie turned 13, and she too was tall and gangly. Katie turned out to be 6 foot tall, and Katie would be shooting baskets, but Katie never said what Troy said. When she was 13, she'd come and knock on the door, holler or whatever, and say, Dad, come out here. And she would always say these things. Hey, Dad, would you come out here and stay with me while I shoot baskets? Or, hey, Dad, would you come shoot baskets with me? Everything for a gal is relational. Troy is married to a 29-year-old woman who has 3 children. And the desire of Molly's heart is still this basic desire. Do you have time for me? Do I matter? Am I important to you? And when Troy loves his wife, he will love her because he will communicate to her that nothing in life competes for my affection. I go to work a lot, but you matter more than my work. And I love the kids, but I love you, the mother of my kids. And I want to invest in you. You see, if you don't have wholeness or wellness or maturity, you can't do those things. Get out of a relationship until you grow up. No, you won't be perfect. I know that. I understand that. But you better know what road you're on. And get out of a relationship till you're with somebody who is mature. No, they won't be perfect, and but you better know what road they're on. Maturity is essential. The biblical word for it is wisdom or wholeness. Does that make sense? The last two won't take near as long. They're really, really important. But the last two I will go much faster. Number two, marry someone who's a believer. You marry someone who is a believer. I don't mean the storefront kind of believer. I don't mean the Me Too kind of believer. I don't mean the shallow kind of believer. I don't mean the nod your head and yell, I love Jesus too believer. I'm talking about the kind of person who has experienced a life transformation by Jesus Christ. I'm talking about the kind of person who knows what it is to drink deep of the Spirit of God and to understand what it means. If somebody cannot live in harmony with their Creator and Redeemer who loves them perfectly, they'll have a heck of a time living with you who will love them imperfectly. If they cannot live with the right one in their life, their Creator, with a great passionate love for Him, they will have a great deal of difficulty loving you. They have unfinished business with a Creator. Marry a believer. My mom did not marry a believer. My father was an unbeliever. My father was a good man. My father was a man of great integrity, a man I've always admired. But I grew up in the home that I was in, and my father was not Christian. Did it turn out okay? Yes, it did. Yeah, it did. My father became a strong believer in his 40s. My father is 80 now. My father's been an elder in his church for 20 plus years. My father's a very, very good man. But I'm going to tell you, the home I grew up in is not the home that I would want you to grow up in, and just due to the issues that it brings about. I've told this story more than once. I was married myself, and I'm walking across the yard with my father. who's a lot like John Wayne, if you want to sort of picture what my father's like. And as we walked across the yard, I commented on some tree that I remember was planted when I was in high school. I helped plant the tree that day with Dad. And I'm just walking by, and again, I just point out, I said, man, that tree's grown a bunch. And I remember the day we planted that, and we hadn't gone three or four more steps, and my father said, I hate that tree. That's a little odd. I just waited a second. We went a few more steps, and my father said, the day we planted that tree was the day I was trying to decide whether to leave your mother or not. My father has, for, I don't even know, do the math, 45, 50 years. My father has seen a tree that reminds him of the day he was trying to decide to stay with my mom or not. They've ended up with a great marriage, a wonderful marriage. They moved from one of these two over to here, but it wasn't without scars. Can you marry an unbeliever and turn out with a great marriage? Yes, you can. Can you drive really fast in the fog and arrive safe and alive? Sure you can. Just that most don't. Might work for you. Might work. Drive really fast through the fog, it may turn out fine. Statistically, it doesn't turn out fine. There are 8 normal consequences if you marry an unbeliever. You need to know these are what will take place. Those 8 consequences are these. Number 1, you'll find your own faith is harder to hang on to. Oh, you can live a life of light in the middle of darkness. In fact, darkness won't put out light at all. You can bring in truckloads of darkness and it won't put light out. So yes, you can hang on to your faith, but it is harder. All of us who ever do anything that matters in life, it's just easier when there are people cheering you on for the right thing. And if you're married to somebody who's not cheering you on in your faith, you'll just find it harder to hang on to. Number 2, the faith of your children is weaker and harder for them to hang on to. It's less likely your children have faith. You let a child grow up in a home where daddy, I'll use this illustration, where daddy doesn't love Christ and where mom does, you'll have a child who probably up through 5th, 6th, 7th grade is very involved in the kingdom, but about 7th, 8th, 9th grade, it becomes very difficult for them to make the distinction between why doesn't and adulthood and so forth, and it's much less. Now, there are great kids who come out of single-parent homes in the sense of single-parent homes, but single-faith homes. I mean, Joseph comes out of a dysfunctional family, and Joseph's one of my greatest heroes in all Scripture, so you can do it, but the faith... it's just harder for children. Number 3, the tension in the marriage is higher. You marry an unbeliever, you'll just have higher tension in your home. Your home will just be a little less of a relaxed place. You marry an unbeliever, you're going to find that friendships with other couples is harder to hang on to. You'll just have less friends you can run around with. Because the friends he wants to run around with, you're not quite as comfortable with, and the friends you want to run around with and really spend time and play cards and stay up till midnight and all those sort of things, just doing stuff, he's not as interested in. And you'll just find yourself a little more isolated. Number 5, you'll find the family does fewer things together. You'll kind of go separate routes a little more. You'll leave notes on the table because you go this route and he goes that route or vice versa. And you'll just do less things together. If you want to live more of a separate life within your marriage, marry an unbeliever. Other moral issues will raise their head. What are you going to do with issues like alcohol? What are you going to do with issues like abortion? What are you going to do with issues like politics and so forth? And the answer is you're going to find all kinds of just really struggling over moral issues that you handle differently. Number 7, you're going to find that the family ties to extended family are more strained. You'll be less involved. I guarantee you, you'll be less involved with the grandparents. You'll be less involved with the aunts and uncles because ultimately what you're dealing with is cultures that don't integrate as well. And number 8, you'll find that the Christian witness is shaded. Now, don't misunderstand me. You can serve Christ any way you want to, and you can do magnificent, powerful things. And some of the greatest people advancing the kingdom in our congregation are single faith individuals in a family, but it's still shaded because you can't use the family finances the way you'd like to serve Christ. You can't use the family a house like you'd like to serve Christ. You can't use just your time all the ways you'd like to serve Christ. And so you serve, but you just don't serve in ways you could if you were married to a believer. There's a lady in our congregation who wrote this. She said, "I picked a man with a good head on his shoulders. I picked a man who made me feel good. I picked a man whose heart was good. I picked a man who was handsome, and I was proud to stand between. But I also picked a man whose heart and head were never turned toward God. Our marriage has had many good things, but we could never talk of a creator. We couldn't discuss the faith of our children. We couldn't agree about praying or tithing. We couldn't even talk about what would happen to us when we die. Yes, I married a good man, but I also lost many good things, things I never wanted to give up. Marry a man whose heart has been turned toward God." The third one, number three. First one is marry somebody who's wise. By the way, you'll recognize there are many believers who are not wise and whole and well, because sin has gone deeper and has destroyed more that's not been repaired yet. So those are two separate. You marry someone who's wise and whole and well and someone who's a believer. Those don't automatically overlap. Number three, you marry someone who understands the covenant concept of marriage. Marry someone who understands the covenant concept of marriage. This one you've already picked up on, and it's already pretty obvious, so I'll go quick. But in the book of Malachi, God says your marriage is not yours, it's His. He calls it in the book of Malachi His covenant, His marriage. In a sense, when I stood here and married Julie K. Lawrence, I didn't exchange my vows with Julie. Oh, it may look like it. My vows were actually given to the Lord. And the covenant concept of marriage is, God, I vow before you, you brought this woman into the world, I will be your man in her life. I'll be your ambassador in her life for her good on your behalf as long as I live. My marriage license itself from the state of Oklahoma, my wife's from Waukeeta, Oklahoma. It's famous for the movie Twister. That's actually the church we got married in is seen in that movie. Aunt Peg's house is in that movie Twister, that old movie. That was Julie's sister's house. Hey, you can touch me later if you want to. My brush with greatness, I'm telling you. Me and Helen Hunt are just like that. I'm just telling you, that's just like that. But anyhow, where was I on this? Thank you. I actually didn't need that. She told me where I was. The older I get, the more that happens. The state of Oklahoma, the marriage license has on it a covenant marriage between Randy Garris and Julie Lawrence. That's not true. My vows are before God, and my covenant's with God. That's true of my wife as well. There have been many, many times my wife would be so frustrated with me because I have feet of clay and I'm as hard to love as anybody else, and harder in some ways maybe, I don't know. I don't want to be. But my wife, as her act of worship, has loved me the same on those days as much as the days that I was easy to love. Why? Because her covenant was with God. If my covenant's with Julie and she begins to have a bad day or a bad week or a bad month or a bad year, then if she kind of negotiates down, so to speak, in her own life or character, then if my deal's with her, then I negotiate down where I'm at. But if my deal's with God and Julie has a bad day or a bad week or a bad month, it doesn't change. I have an unchanging God. And so that's why my covenant doesn't change. And the covenant concept of marriage is absolutely indispensable. Family and marriage is not all there is to life, but it is such a key component that it shapes your life more than anything else. My life has been more shaped by the people I chose to love, and they've shaped and molded my life, and vice versa. The reason God gave us marriage is it's one of the sweetest blessings that He had for us. Here's a gift. I want you to have a great gift from me. It's a wonderful gift. And so when you choose a bad marriage, you're really rejecting the very gift God wants to give you. But the other thing about a marriage is not only is a marriage for you, but a marriage is actually also a part of how God even gives His own glory on the face of this earth. Did you notice in Scripture how hard it is for Scripture to describe for us what heaven is going to be like? It's hard for us to grasp what heaven is going to be. I mean, it really is difficult. How do I describe for you a color you've never seen? So when heaven is described, God consistently goes back and says, well, it's kind of like a great marriage. And so we talk about the marriage feast of the Lamb, and we talk about the bride and the groom, and all kinds of those metaphors that are using. Do you realize that a great marriage is a shadow of heaven? It's a lesser shadow, but the shadow of heaven. And if you have a bad marriage that you choose, what you're doing is you're even stealing the glory of God on what it could be and what it ought to be. I think it's not beyond reason to also say that your home will be your primary base of ministry always. I preach in a congregation that runs a couple thousand on Sunday morning. I kind of got a pulpit I'm normally at, but the base of my ministry is not the pulpit or my office at College Heights. The base of my ministry is the house that I share with Julie and with Megan right now, and Sam, my alcoholic nephew who lives with us. And Allison just left, who was a college kid who was living with us. But my home is the base of my ministry. I wish for you a joyful, productive, wonderful place for all those things for you. We've taken our time tonight. Let me just mention a couple of things. Please, I'm not hawking this. I am really not. If you want the DVDs, I've done about 2.5 sessions off the DVDs. There's a 7-part DVD series out there if you want it. They're $30 from the ministry and the company that sells them, but our church buys them for $20 because I'm the guy. I have to buy my own. But I just brought the church's supply, so they're $20 if you want to get those. They're out there. If you want to ask questions later on, you're welcome to email me. I'm not fast at emailing. I get quite a few, and so I'm slow, but I will get back with you. Sometimes it's a couple of weeks before I do, but I'm happy to email back. And so if you're patient, don't think it's I don't care. It's just I have a little trouble keeping it up sometimes, but I'm happy to do so. I'll stick around tonight. Last night I left here a little bit, but I'll stick around tonight. We can talk anything you want to. I'm happy to do so. I've got all day to get home tomorrow, so I'm not too worried about it. Tomorrow morning we're going to pick up a little more from a different angle, this idea of wholeness in your own life. How do you become a whole person? And so tomorrow morning is one that I really want to do with you. Any particular questions? I'm going to take about 5 minutes of this. Any particular question that has not made sense to you? Anything you go, wow, Randy, you went right by a Mack truck hole and it hasn't made sense and you're skirting that issue. Any questions anybody wants to ask? Other than, can you talk forever or ever shut up? I mean, any questions? Yes. Absolutely. Okay. She's asking about number two. I said you have to have a box that you date with. Did you notice tonight I tried to fill in your box? Tonight I tried to fill it in. Now, I granted, okay, because somebody's wise and somebody's a believer and somebody understands the covenant concept of marriage, those are the essential ones. Now, do we have personality traits within that? Sure. You might have three wise people that are godly and they understand covenant concept of marriage, and you say, well, I don't want any one of those three. You know, I mean, they're great individuals, but that's, you know, I mean, I understand there's personal things, but those are the essentials. Those are the given. Those you hang on to, okay? But you switch at some point in time and say, okay, they've met their criteria. The next criteria is, am I ready to become a selfless man who's ready to invest in them? Am I ready to make my act of worship the rest of my life? And there comes a time, I can't tell you when it is. It's not a date on a calendar after 12 dates, you know. I mean, it's not, I mean, literally, there comes a place where you say, okay, they have met their part, wise and whole. And now your question is, am I ready? Am I ready to marry this individual and make my act of worship to the Lord to share life and the rest of my journey with them? We had a gal that I struggled this through with her just a few years back. I guess time gets away, about 5 years ago. She said, there's this great guy in my life, and he meets all the criteria of everything I want. And she said, I get lots of pressure, even from my inside me, but from other people going, you guys ought to get married. You guys ought to get married. And she said, you know, I know we could have a great marriage. But I just also have this great desire to go do this mission work kind of thing. And I don't think that would work for the both of us. And she said, is it wrong to walk by the guy you think that could be right for you because you have other dreams and other hopes? Well, of course it's right. Nobody says you have to get married. And there'll come a time and place where you decide, yeah, that's how I want to live out my act of worship, by investing in this guy the rest of my life and sharing this journey. But if you have other hopes and other dreams, it's perfectly fine to walk by that guy, so to speak, or that gal. That's okay. It's not like, hey, you had one chance and you missed it in life. That isn't the case. So their situation is they have to sort of be within that box of wisdom and wholeness. Then you've got to decide whether you are as well. And now are you ready to make that jump and make it your act of worship? It's a funny line, and that's what I told Katie that day, by the way. Katie said, Dad, how will I know when I'm ready to do that? I said, sweetheart, it's the stupidest answer a parent can give, but you'll know. You'll wake up one morning, and you're going to go, this is what I want to do. It is something I cannot quantify. You just have to make sure all the criteria is there before you do it. Somebody have an easier question? Any other questions? May God bless thee, wherever that goes. See you.